This is the Africa service of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to our half-hour daily program for Africa.
In today's program, you can hear our feature, Justice and Peace. First, however, our bulletin of church news, followed by Africa News Panorama. We shall close today's program with Sports Roundup. I am Festus Tarawali. Pope Francis is continuing with treatment, physical therapy and concelebrating Mass at his Casa Santa Marta residence in the Vatican, the Holy See Press Office noted on Tuesday as it provided updates to journalists on the Holy Father's recovery. The press office also said Pope Francis continues some work-related activities but is not currently receiving visitors and that no decisions have been made regarding his schedule for the weeks to come. Deborah Castellano-Lubov reports.
Pope Francis's convalescence continues at his residence of Casa Santa Marta with his continued treatment, mobility and respiratory-related physical therapy, especially for voice recovery, the Holy See Press Office noted on Tuesday. They said he spends his time praying, doing some work, and has been concelebrating Mass in one of his residence's little chapels. No precise details have been provided regarding the Pope's schedule for the coming days, nor for future events such as the various Jubilee celebrations or Holy Week rites. His recovery is being closely monitored, and they are awaiting the expected clinical improvements. The Pope needs a convalescence period of a good 2 months. The Holy See Press Office noted on Tuesday that some decisions are under consideration and will be made based on the improvements that occur in the coming weeks. Wednesday, the general audience will not take place, just as it had not in the previous weeks. Instead, the prepared text of the Pope's catechesis will, as it has been in the past, be distributed in written form. The same is likely to happen on Sunday for the Angelus, though updates are still awaited. Both Dr. Alfieri and Dr. Carbone, who spoke at Gemelli on Saturday, previously mentioned the good spirits the Pope regained. The most dangerous phase of his illness has passed, and the most severe infections, they noted, have been overcome, in which his life was at danger. In an interview published on Tuesday with Corriere della Sera, Dr. Alfieri recalled that the most serious moment occurred on the afternoon of February 28th, when Pope Francis's condition worsened due to a bronchospasm crisis. For the first time, he said, I saw tears in the eyes of some of the people around him, people who, as I have come to understand during the hospitalization, truly love him as a father. We were all aware that the situation had deteriorated further and that there could be a real risk he may not make it. The doctor said we had to decide whether to stop and let him go or to push forward with all possible medications and therapies, despite the high risk of damaging other organs. In the end, Dr. Alfieri said we chose to fight, saying that the final decision was made by the Pope himself. Pope Francis, the doctor noted, from the beginning, has insisted on being fully informed about his health from day one and to share with everyone all the details. I'm Deborah Castellano-Lubov.
Pope Francis has sent a message to participants in the plenary assembly of the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors currently taking place in the Vatican. In the message written a few days before he was discharged from hospital, the Pope encouraged the commission to continue its precious work to ensure that the Church is a safe place for minors and vulnerable people. He also emphasized the critical importance of helping in the healing process of survivors. Lisa Zengarini reports.
In the message which he signed on the 20th of March before he was discharged from Gemelli Hospital, Pope Francis encouraged the Pontifical Commission to continue its precious service to the Church. He remarked that its mission cannot be reduced to the mere application of protocols and good practices, but involves promoting safeguards, integrating education, prevention and listening. By establishing prevention policies, even in the remotest communities, he said, the Commission contributes to a collective commitment that every child and vulnerable person will find safety within the Church. To advance this mission, the Pope asked for 3 commitments. First, he called for increased collaboration between the Commission and the dicasteries of the Roman Curia. Second, he urged the Commission to offer hospitality and care for the spiritual wounds of victims and survivors in the style of the Good Samaritan, a style that moves beyond bureaucratic procedures and instead fosters genuine healing through mercy. Third, Pope Francis emphasized the importance of building partnerships with entities outside the Church, including civil authorities, experts and associations, so that safeguarding may become a universal language. Acknowledging the progress made over the past decade in building a safety network within the Church, the Pope insisted on the importance of listening to the pain of survivors, warning against the temptation to dismiss grief instead of healing it. Concluding, Pope Francis thanked the Commission members for their prayerful closeness as he recovers from pneumonia and assured them of his own spiritual accompaniment. I am Lisa Zengarini.
The annual course on the internal forum organized by the Apostolic Penitentiary is currently taking place in Rome. The course, which is in its 35th edition, seeks to guide priests and candidates to the priesthood studying in Rome in the art of administering the sacrament of reconciliation. The Apostolic Penitentiary is chiefly a tribunal of mercy responsible for issues relating to the forgiveness of sins in the Catholic Church. On this Tuesday, the 25th of March, the Church commemorates the Feast of the Annunciation. The Solemnity of the Annunciation celebrates the visit of the Archangel Gabriel to the Virgin Mary to announce to her that she will be the mother of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Two examples that highlight the importance of this feast are the joyous mysteries of the Rosary and the Angelus. This Tuesday, the 25th of March, also marks the 30th anniversary of the encyclical Evangelium Vitae, or the Gospel of Life, written by Pope St. John Paul II in 1995 to reaffirm the value and inviolability of every human life and to appeal to all people to respect, protect, love and serve every human life. To mark the occasion, the Dicastery for Laity, Family and Life has published a pastoral framework on how to initiate ecclesial processes to promote pastoral care of human life, including how to defend, safeguard and promote it worldwide in a time marked by extremely serious violations of human dignity. The volume titled Life is Always a Good, Initiating Processes for a Pastoral Care of Human Life is available for free use and download in English, Italian and Portuguese on the Dicastery's website. Cardinal Kevin Farrell, the prefect of the Dicastery, introduces the work, observing how life in all situations and states must be safeguarded. And as the world marks the International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade this Tuesday, the 25th of March, the UN Secretary General has released a video message reiterating the imperative to put into place reparatory justice frameworks that address the terrible history of slavery and its legacies. Antonio Gutierrez also called for an end to the evil of racism. The 25th of March also marks the International Day of Solidarity with Detained and Missing Staff Members. You're tuned to the Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
African News Panorama.
Health authorities in the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, have confirmed that a deadly outbreak in Equator Province was caused by malaria. The National Public Health Institute announced that lab tests identified malaria as the illness responsible for 52 deaths and over 900 infections since the start of the year. Initially, professionals suspected either malaria or food poisoning. While malaria has now been confirmed, additional tests are being conducted on food and water samples. A similar outbreak last December was also traced to malaria. South Sudan is on the verge of renewed civil war, the United Nations top official Mr. Nicholas Haysom has warned. The warning follows the government's unexpected delay on the peace process, pushing elections from 2023 to 2026. Despite a peace deal in 2018, violence is escalating, particularly in the north, where government forces are clashing with a White Army militia believed to support the first vice president, Riek Machar. Recent attacks include an assault on a military base and the donning of a United Nations helicopter. The United Nations warns that rising ethnic divisions, misinformation, and hate speech are fueling tensions. To prevent further conflict, international and regional bodies, including the African Union, are urging President Salva Kiir and Vice President Machar to uphold the peace deals, maintain the ceasefire, and resolve disputes through dialogue. Angola has announced its decision to step down as mediator in the ongoing conflict between the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, and the M23 rebel group. Angolan President Juan Lourenço, who was appointed mediator by the African Union in 2022, said that Angola will now work with the African Union to find a new mediator. The decision comes shortly after peace talks in Luanda were cancelled following the withdrawal of the M23, citing the sanctions by the European Union on its leaders. Meanwhile, Qatar hosted talks between the leaders of Rwanda and the DRC, where both sides reaffirmed their commitment to an immediate ceasefire. However, tensions remain high, with the M23 recently advancing further into the interior parts of the DRC. You are tuned to the Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
You are welcome to this week's edition of Justice and Peace. Tension is steadily rising in Southeast Sudan as clashes between government troops and a militia group known as the White Army continue in Upper Nile State. Fighting started early this month when the militias overran a government military garrison in Nasir Town and also took control of the town. According to diplomatic sources, the White Army has always been an ally of First Vice President Riek Machar and his party, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, also known as the Anti-Governmental Forces. Similarly, Mr. Machar has many supporters in Nasir who have long opposed the leadership of the country's President Salva Kiir. The town of Nasir is located a short distance from the Ethiopian border. Nicholas Haysom is the head of the United Nations peace mission in Southeast Sudan. From Juba, he explained the situation on the ground.
The political and security situation has significantly deteriorated since the White Army, that's a youth militia, overran barracks previously occupied by the South Sudan People's Defense Forces in Nasir on the 4th of March. In retaliation, communities across Upper Nile are being subjected to persistent aerial bombardment using devices, barrel bombs, allegedly containing a highly flammable liquid. These indiscriminate attacks on civilians are causing significant casualties and horrific injuries, especially burns, including to women and children. We're receiving reports of further mobilization of White Army and SS-PDF forces in Upper Nile, allegedly including children forcibly recruited into the ranks of the respective armed formations.
As Mr. Haysom has said, the government of Southeast Sudan has responded to the situation militarily, but it has also reacted politically.
On the political front, some senior military and civilian officials affiliated with the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition have been replaced or removed from their official positions, while others have been detained, gone into hiding, or fled the country. Rampant misinformation, disinformation, and hate speech is also ratcheting up tensions and driving ethnic divisions and fear. Given this grim situation, we are left with no other conclusion but to assess that South Sudan is on the edge of a relapse into civil war.
The White Army militia fighters are reported to have killed many people suspected to be supporters of President Kiri, including a senior military officer who died when a helicopter sent to Nasir to evacuate him was attacked. The situation has been complicated further by Uganda, which has sent hundreds of special forces to protect the government of President Kiri from any possible attacks from opposition groups.
The deployment of foreign forces at the request of the South Sudan government is fueling further fear and anxiety across the country, which in its experience is finding this reminiscent of the conflict, the civil war in 2013, the first of the civil wars that the country has experienced since its independence in 2011.
Humanitarian agencies say the fighting has displaced more than 50,000 people within Upper Nile State, while a few hundreds have fled to North Ethiopia. President Kiri and Mr. Machar are blaming each other for violating the 2018 peace agreement that they both signed to end the civil war that started in 2013 as a result of a power struggle between them. Fear of a large-scale conflict engulfed South Sudan last week when Mr. Machar's party announced its withdrawal from the security arrangements of the 2018 peace agreement. Regional and international leaders have called upon the two men to resolve their differences through dialogue.
UNMISS is engaging in intense shuttle diplomacy alongside international and regional peace partners, including the African Union, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, and the reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission. This quartet held an urgent meeting to explore further steps that can be taken to convince the parties to pull back from the brink. The region and the international community have also been actively engaged. The Security Council and the African Union Peace and Security Council both met last week. Earlier, IGAD met at the heads of state, the summit level, and decided to dispatch a ministerial subcommittee to Juba to mediate and lend support to the parties to return to the revitalized peace agreement. Unfortunately, a high-level visit by IGAD foreign ministers to Juba was postponed to the 3rd of April by the government at the last minute and without explanation. This is a disappointing development at a time when diplomatic outreach is more important than ever. The efforts of the international community to broker a peaceful solution can only succeed if the parties themselves are willing to engage and put the interests of their people ahead of their own.
South Sudan has been relatively peaceful, and indeed last year Mr. Machar and President Kiri agreed to postpone for 2 years the general elections that had been scheduled for last December. In early 2023, Pope Francis traveled to the country to support the consolidation of the peace process. Why has tension erupted now? Professor Abraham Nyon is a lecturer in political science at the University of Juba. He explains.
This came as a result of the mistrust that has been existing between the government and the opposition parties. Government trying to consolidate power. The government has tried to make some changes to effect issues within the position that had been held by the opposition without consulting with them. The two principals want to keep their armies intact, which does not happen in a sovereign country. Trying to refuse to unify the army from both sides has become the issue across the country.
Mr. Nicholas Haysom has made the following appeal to President Salva Kiri and to Mr. Riek Machar.
There is only one way out of the cycle of conflict, and that is to return to the revitalized peace agreement in letter and spirit. This includes strict adherence to the ceasefire, the release of detained officials or their treatment in accordance with legal process, an immediate return to consensus-based decision-making, and the resolution of tensions through dialogue rather than military confrontation. We also encourage the President and First Vice President to meet to resolve their differences constructively, making a joint public statement that reassures all South Sudanese of their united, steadfast commitment to peace.
Nicholas Haysom, the head of the United Nations Peace Mission in Southeast Sudan, speaking there from Juba. And that was Justice and Peace for this week. This has been Johnny Baptist Tumusime.
This is a sports roundup and welcome to the program. My name is Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba. Newly elected International Olympic Committee President Kirsty Coventry arrived back in her home country of Zimbabwe on Sunday to a hero's welcome as her victory is celebrated as a national milestone. The 41-year-old Coventry, who is also Zimbabwe's sports minister, was the only female candidate in the International Olympic Committee presidential race. Her victory made her become the first woman, first Zimbabwean, and first African to be elected head of the Global Olympic Movement. She beat six other candidates in the vote in Greece on Thursday, including the head of International Cycling Union, David Lapantier, who is also a member of Jordan's royal family. The president of the World Athletics, Sebastian Coe of the United Kingdom. Dancers stormed the ground as part of a traditional African folklore dance to the sound of trumpets and drums to welcome Coventry home as she arrived at Robert Gabriel Mugabe International Airport in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare. Some people may be wondering who this Coventry is. Well, she is an ex-Zimbabwe swimmer and was the back-to-back Olympic champion in the 200 meters backstroke at the 2004 and 2006 games. She retired from swimming after the Rio de Janeiro Olympics in 2016 with 7 Olympic medals and is the most decorated Olympian from Africa. And now, after this historic Olympic election, comes leadership issues for the International Olympic Committee President Kirsty Coventry. She has already said she will resign from her Zimbabwe minister's job in order to move to the Olympic home city of Lausanne in Switzerland. Her 8-year term in charge of the International Olympic Committee begins in June. Pressing issues at the Olympic body include athletics benefits, gender eligibility, and how to deal with United States President Donald Trump, with Los Angeles set to host the next Summer Olympics in 2028. Kenya's Gilbert Kiprotich and Loiche Chemnung won as the East African country dominated the podium of the men and women's races at the Malaga Half Marathon in Spain on Sunday. Kiprotich clocked 58 minutes and 27 seconds to take first place ahead of fellow countrymen Patrick Kabirech Mosin and Richard Yato, who finished second and third respectively. On the other hand, Chemnung timed 1 hour 5 minutes and 46 seconds to top the women's race ahead of another Kenyan, Miriam Chebet, who clocked 1 hour 7 minutes and 1 second. In second, Ugandan Joy Cheptoyek completed the podium in third, clocking 1 hour 8 minutes. Elsewhere, Simon Mwangi and Maureen Jesare won the men and women's races respectively at the Stramilano Half Marathon in Milan in Italy. Mwangi clocked 1 hour and 54 seconds to cut the tape ahead of Rwandese's Yves Nimuboma, who finished second in 1 hour 1 minute and 18 seconds. The 2016 Africa Cross Country bronze medalist Charles Mneria finished third in 1 hour 2 minutes and 8 seconds. In the women's competition, Jesare led a podium sweep for Kenya, timing 1 hour 8 minutes and 47 seconds in first place. Stella Chebet came second in 1 hour 11 minutes and 19 seconds, as another Kenyan, Monica Chebet Chepkwon, clinched third in 1 hour 11 minutes and 25 seconds. Tunisia left it to the last minute to secure a crucial 2-0 win over a stubborn Malawi side. The victory made them tighten their grip at the top of Group H in the 2026 FIFA World Cup African qualifiers. The result sees Tunisia move to 13 points from 5 matches, 4 ahead of second place to Namibia, who were held to a 1-1 draw by Equatorial Guinea earlier in the day. Ethiopia, meantime, revived their campaign in emphatic fashion with a stunning 6-1 rout of Djibouti in Group A. With 2 matches remaining, both Tunisia and Ethiopia have given their fans renewed hope. While Tunisia is eyeing a return to the World Cup, Ethiopia is showing they may yet have a say in Group A's final outcome. Meantime, the International Association for Football Federations, FIFA, has confirmed receiving a formal complaint from Liberia following the Lone Stars 1-0 defeat to Tunisia on Wednesday, March 19, 2025, in the ongoing World Cup qualifiers. The protest centers on allegations of officiating misconduct by Ivorian referee Clement Franklin Kipan, who officiated the match. Acting on the advice of the Minister of Sports, the Liberian Football Association submitted the complaint on March 20th, accusing the referee of denying the Lone Star 3 legitimate penalty appeals. Liberia is now calling for a rematch on the grounds that officiating errors adversely impacted the final result. Responding to the concerns, FIFA's head of qualifiers and international matches, Gordon Savic, confirmed the receipt of Liberia's protest, and he assured that the matter would be referred to FIFA's refereeing and disciplinary committees for evaluation. And on that note, we come to the end of today's edition of our Sports Roundup. Until next week, at the same time, my name is Kanyan Tagodufri Kampamba.
You have been listening to the English Africa Service of Vatican Radio. In our next program at the same time tomorrow, you can hear our feature, Health and Healing. I am Festus Tarawali, and do join us then. Praised be Jesus Christ. Laudetur Jesus Christus.